bratwurst, also pierogies, fried sides, and more. The market is open Saturdays from 9 until 2 on 2nd Avenue and Plaza Du Way. This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be about Azure and some Windows 10 versioning and update things that you need to be aware of. And if I have time, I'll get off onto a couple other smaller topics. So let's start with Azure. Now, some of you have heard about it. Other people are like, what in the world is Azure? Well, Azure is a platform that Microsoft owns that is very similar to Amazon Web Services or a company that's been around a long time called Rackspace. And Rackspace is, for example, a place where you can provision, you can purchase and provision a virtual server. There are other virtualized services that you can provision from them as well. So it's effectively a way of cloudifying your resources, but then potentially still having them be reasonably private to your individual company's needs. So while you don't have the hardware and you're not feeding it the electricity and you're not feeding it the internet connection and the UPS and the facility fee and these sorts of things, you are paying via a subscription fee for another provider to do that for you. And this makes sense in a lot of cases. Say, for example, here's really probably the best example that anyone could probably ever come up with is an idea of a website. I'm just going to say the Susan G. Komen Foundation is an example. All right. Here's a website of an organization that has the need to automatically scale with demand. So let's say there's certain months of the year that they have really, really, really high demand on their website, and they want the horsepower behind the website to be able to scale to keep up with that need so that the website continues to function appropriately. And considering the volume of what they're doing, then it makes sense and is cost effective to incur the additional cost profile of having this dynamic scaling capability. And I've heard that some websites like that can incur charges that are approximately $30,000 in 1 month for website hosting fees, simply because maybe they're doing $1 million worth of transactions per month. And again, 30 grand per month is not something that's outrageous. I know of Fortune 500 companies who used to pay exactly that amount of money on a monthly basis to an email filtration service, or otherwise known as a smart host. So where you and I probably think $30,000 a month for anything is way past outrageous, depending upon the scale of what the organization is doing, that's actually cost effective for them, because they could not achieve that kind of level of service on in-house or on-premise in their own infrastructure with their own people for that amount of money. They just couldn't do it, right? So when you're faced with something that's effectively saying, look, there's no possible way that I could cost effectively achieve that level of functionality and feature for that cost profile if I did it myself, that is the time that you need to go to a hosted solution provider, whether it be Amazon Web Services, Rackspace, Azure, hosted email, hosted QuickBooks, you name it. That is the exact time that those sorts of solutions are appropriate and make sense. Now, a lot of this, though, like, for example, hosted email has been around for over 20 years, way more than that, actually. But that is also something that is, I'm not going to say like the easiest thing on the planet to migrate, because it's not. I mean, email migrations are some of the most complex migrations you can do. But moving email services is totally possible. And on the back end, changing the way that you pay for those email services is also extremely flexible without interrupting service. That's very important to understand. A lot of what I do here on this show is educate you so that you don't get taken advantage of intentionally or unintentionally by a service provider. And so that's going to be a lot of this next part of the conversation here. So when we're looking at a service like Azure, where you want to consume some things that could potentially be hosted on Azure, maybe it's a virtual machine, maybe it's Azure AD domain services, maybe it's the application gateway functionality, maybe it's anything like that. You need to be aware of some extremely very expensive, huge implication and dangerous things about the limitations in Azure that I personally find just downright stupid as to why Microsoft does it this way. And this is nothing new. I've told Microsoft directly, and I've publicly posted it already, that I think the way that they do this is stupid, and it has a lot of very adverse impact on businesses. So I now want to make you aware of that issue as well. So everything that is in Azure is paid for by a subscription. So you first are effectively putting in a payment method. And that is what's called a subscription. So your payment method is a subscription. Then resources are attached to that subscription. And then they are provisioned based off of that resource group. Now, there's a lot of very technical detail in there associated with that, but you need to understand that once a lot of these resources are provisioned, they are permanently attached to that subscription. And remember that the subscription is the method of payment. So what this means is that if you wish to change the method of payment, well, you can't. Not without literally tearing down those resources and destroying them and paying somebody to rebuild them from scratch, which is oftentimes just not even remotely practical. So it's not only not cost effective, but not practical. So you ultimately get locked into a particular payment method. So if you're going to consume Azure services, it is my very strong recommendation to you that you just simply use what is called the PAYGO method. The PAYGO method is a subscription model that allows you to put your credit card of choice in there and to pay for it. Now, if you're a company that wishes to be invoiced instead, you can still have a PAYGO method and just be invoiced, but it's still the PAYGO method. Remember I said, once the payment methodology, the payment style has been established, that subscription is there and it cannot be changed. You can't convert a PAYGO method subscription to an Azure credit subscription or an enterprise agreement subscription or a CSP model subscription. It can't be converted. If you, for example, wanted to say, well, I don't want to pay by the PAYGO anymore because that's 100% cost profile, I could get a small discount if I pay by Azure credits. Okay. So you go and you try to get Azure credits, you go ahead and you load those into your Azure tenant, and you end up finding out that, well, sure, the Azure credits are in there, but you can't move a significant portion, if any, of the resources that you already have provisioned to be paid by this alternate payment method. They can't be moved. And I mean, I'm serious when I tell you the list of things that cannot be moved is very, very long. And if a movable resource is associated with or is dependent upon an immovable resource, well, you may not be able to move that either. So the thing you need to be aware of with this is that there's a ton of consulting providers out there that are looking at trying to get you onto a CSP Azure payment methodology. Now, that CSP Azure payment methodology is exclusively a payment methodology that is provided through their organization. So first off, how long have they been in business? Do you really want to be, you know, being in business with them for effectively permanently? And there's an element of delegated admin that is associated with this CSP billing. So here's the other thing. If you don't trust them to be your delegated admin for whatever these resources are, then you really should not be consuming those services over CSP billing. Now, the other problem with CSP billing is, let's say you have consulting firm A that you've been doing business with. They provision your Azure resources to be paid by a CSP billing method through them. And then later on, you decide you don't want to do business with that consulting firm anymore. So now you hire another consulting firm and you tell them, yes, I've got this Azure thing. And, you know, I mean, I need you to like deal with that. And they go and they look at it. And I would say in a significant percentage of time, what they will find is that they literally cannot migrate, even with the help of Microsoft, they cannot migrate all of those resources. So no matter what you do, you will be stuck in a billing relationship with the old consulting firm, which also means that they will have a level of delegated admin into your Azure as well, which again, you may not want. So nobody else is going to tell you this, because these are hard topics, and these are topics that are, you know, I'm sitting here telling you, sure, go ahead and use whatever consulting firm you want in order to do the services on your Azure tenant. But what I'm saying is, do not consume Azure resources through Azure credits or through CSP billing, because it will come back and bite you later, and you will dramatically regret making that decision. So I'm advocating that you only consume Azure. If you're going to consume Azure, you only consume it on a PayGo subscription, which is basically you're either direct billed on your credit card or it gets invoiced to you directly by Microsoft. And will you be paying full price? Oh, yes, you will. There's no discount for that. You won't get any discount. But I can tell you that the discount is not so significant via the other methods to make it worth it for you to encounter and deal with all of these other horrible issues from my perspective, right? And if I thought it was cost effective, I would tell you so. Now, one of the other challenges with Azure is that it is extremely difficult to predict what the billing is going to be, because most of these things are not fixed price. So if you buy Office 365, you know what that cost is going to be, because it's like, okay, here's the service. This is what you get in the service, and it's this fee per month or per year, right? You get that as straightforward. It's predictable. Azure is not predictable. So for example, if you just say, oh, well, I've got this project I want to do, and I need Azure AD domain services, and we only have, you know, 30 people in the organization, well, you will be paying the same amount of monthly fee for Azure AD domain services, which I'm going to say is not the same thing as Azure AD, so don't get them confused. They're two different things. Azure AD is a different animal from Azure AD domain services. Okay, Azure AD domain services is it's another level of functionality. And if you provision that, and you're only a 30-person company, that's never going to be cost-effective, because it's probably going to cost you $130 a month. Now, the Azure AD domain services for an organization that has, say, 500 employees, that might actually be very cost-effective for them to do on a monthly basis when it's only costing $130 a month. So If you don't know what the prices of these things are going in, and I can tell you from experience that it is extremely difficult to accurately predict what these costs are going to be. That is oftentimes this whole consumption-based billing thing is not what organizations want to get into. And then the other problem is if you go and pay into this to the point where you pay somebody to set up all this stuff for you, well, now you're stuck with it. You're fixed, right? There it is. If you want to continue to have that functionality, you have to continue to pay those subscription fees, whatever the heck they are. There's a company that we know that is paying almost $1,000 a month in Azure fees for an application that is utilized by roughly 12 individuals in their company. I mean, how is that cost effective? Well, they got into that situation because they were dealing with a software development company who didn't really understand Azure, didn't really understand the cost profile of things, and at some point in time, the organization has paid so much money in consulting fees for a piece of functionality, and then they have become reliant upon that piece of functionality that they keep just throwing money at it. Because if you don't pay the $1,000 a month, well, the whole thing turns off, and then what do you have? So it's, you have to say, well, if we look at it in terms of how much money would it take for us to migrate off of that? Let's say it's $6,000. You'd effectively get a return on investment of that in 6 months, right? In 6 months, you'd end up being able to stop paying for those $1,000 a month Azure hosting fees, and because now whatever it is that you're doing with pre-existing on-premise resources. So, one of the big pieces of the moral of the story here is so many people are going all like, oh, cloudy, cloud, cloud, cloud. And they're like, oh, we ought to just move all of our workloads into the cloud. Well, my statement is, do you actually understand what you're getting into? Because it's way easier to look at the CapEx, so the capital expenditure approach of saying, all right, I'm going to have this facility, I'm going to have an internet connection, I'm going to buy some network equipment and things. And I'm then going to have these physical servers that I'm going to buy, maybe one server, maybe two. And I know how much that costs because I know what the acquisition cost is. And I also have much more control over the maintenance costs of that as well. On the other hand, if I get into this whole, I'm going to provision the equivalent level of capabilities in terms of cloud-hosted services. Here's where the cost breakdown is. Every single time I've run the calculation, what it comes out to is if you provision that same workload in a cloud-hosted solution provider like Azure or Amazon Web Services or Rackspace, in 18 months of paying for that cloud hosting, you will have already paid for 7 years worth of your on-site hosted stuff. Now, granted, I'm not talking about including the cost of your electricity or your internet connection, or the fact that you have UPSs and maybe you have a generator, and I'm not including the cost of maintenance because so many of those things, you would have incurred those expenses already. And even beyond that, you still incur maintenance for things that are cloud hosted provided anyways. You still, they're not installing patches on those servers. They're not doing backups. You still have to pay for all of that. So I'm literally just talking about if you take the workload and you do a price comparison on the different methods, say like, okay, I'm going to go cloud hosted versus I'm going to go on premise, where it's my equipment that I bought and it's in my facility on my internet connection and I have control over it. In 18 months of paying for the cloud hosted solution, it's the equivalency of paying for 7 years worth of the on-premise solution. And here's the best part. If your on-premise solution is still working after the 7 years, which was the expected life cycle of it, if it's still working after that point in time, then as far as I'm concerned, you're in bonus time. That's just like, woohoo, you know, free bonus time. There is no bonus time in hosting. You will continue to pay the monthly or annual fee, or the hosting gets turned off. That's just the way that it is. And I understand that the OPEX, or the operating expenditure method, is very attractive to certain companies such as, you know, CNH Industrial, because they're a publicly traded company. And for them, they really want to be able to directly tie the consumption during that particular financial reporting period. So the consumption, meaning the expense, tie that to the income that was in that particular consumption period, or otherwise known as that financial reporting period. So if you guys know anything about financial reporting and 10K stock analysis and what stockholders generally want to see, they want to see consistent earnings and consistent expenses. And that leads to a lower beta on the stock. And that by many people's accounts, not mine, but by many people's accounts, makes that stock look more attractive because it has less price volatility and less earnings volatility, okay, or less expense volatility. So one of the ways that financial managers for publicly traded organizations deal with this is they go to a strictly OPEX model as much and as frequently and as often as they can, because CAPEX is expensive. You do have to come up with that chunk of money at that one time, and then you have to amortize it or depreciate it over a certain period of time. But in terms of if you're looking at this in total cost, then the CapEx is almost always more cost effective. So for an organization that is not publicly traded, that does not have to be concerned about price fluctuations and fluctuations in their stock price in general, then those organizations are oftentimes much more interested in actually controlling total cost of ownership. So the CapEx model makes way more sense for them. All right, so that's my word of tale of caution for you for Azure. I'm going to go on to and probably finish up the show here with this topic of Windows 10 and the OS versioning model that's now in place and the security patch process that's in place. I've talked about this a little bit in the past before, but there's some kind of new pieces here to this that you need to be aware of. So Microsoft has publicly announced that they are only going to release two versions of Windows Desktop Operating twice per year. Now, when I say only, kind of being a little bit of a shock there, because historically they'd only do a new OS once every few years, 2-3 years, and then they'd have a support model of supporting that old ancient OS for, like, say, 10-12 years. And that was a model that really didn't work. I don't think it worked. It doesn't work anymore. And so they think it doesn't work anymore either. And so they've just changed, right? And so that means there's going to effectively be a new flavor of Windows 10, or a new release candidate of Windows 10 twice per year. And you can continue to utilize that version of Windows 10 for a while, but eventually, after the 18-month support period has transpired, you will be force upgraded to the newer version of Windows 10. And again, I agree with that as well. My position on this is basically that human beings, by and large, have not demonstrated to a significant degree that they are good at installing security patches on software. And this even includes the IT community. So clearly, what is needed is a more automated force feed method of patch installation. So to me, this is good. Now, as part of this announcement, they were talking about how WSUS, which is Windows Software Update Services, is really getting to the edge of being totally deprecated, meaning it's not even going to remotely be any level of a supported technology anymore. It's being eclipsed by SCCM, which is System Center Configuration Manager, but SCCM is not even remotely practical for most organizations out there to have. It is crazy expensive, requires a huge amount of implementation labor and maintenance and management labor, so it's just not even remotely practical for most organizations. I think, in my opinion, the breakpoint is whether or not you have about 5,000 endpoints. So if your company has about 5,000 endpoints or more, then SCCM could be the right approach for you. If you have less endpoints than that, then you should be considering either, you really should just be considering some alternate methodologies. For really small environments, something like Kaseya is actually the best approach because Kaseya has so many other features to it. Now, you know, we're talking about WSS being deprecated, then, you know, it's important to realize that some of the RMM tools that are on the market, which is remote management and maintenance, some of the RMM tools that are on the market utilize this whole SUS capability. So it's very important that you select an RMM tool that does not rely upon SUS and was never reliant upon that. And I can tell you that Kaseya uses its own system methods, and they are good methods that pick up and they see things that just straight Windows Update does not see. So that's pretty cool too. So since WSS is being deprecated, and if you are using an RMM tool that whose patching methodology was based upon SUS, you're going to have some problems here. So finality here on the show is I found some pretty sweet articles that I'm going to post. One is about the Office Training Center, which is a great useful resource for training office workers on how to use different pieces of Microsoft Office, including Visio and Project, and of course all of your favorites like Word, Outlook, Excel, and PowerPoint. So I'm going to post that link, and if you're interested in that, check it out. It's a free training center for that. There's also a really interesting article about the recent U.S. Navy ship collisions and evaluating whether or not those had occurred because of hacking. So I don't necessarily agree with everything that was in the article, but it was a very interesting article nonetheless, and definitely worth a read. And finally, the whole topic of JavaScript and drive-by downloads hacking your computer has resurfaced recently in the news. And of course, the protections that mitigate this threat are still in place. They're still effective. And if you don't have those protections, then you are still vulnerable to that. And I even recently saw an issue where I was doing a website migration for an organization that had not updated their website content management system in about 4 years. And the damage there is that their website had been hacked. I mean, if you're going to have a content management system and you don't keep it updated, I guarantee you it's going to get hacked. Well, I downloaded that whole thing to a location where Trend Micro Cloud App Security could scan that. And TCAS is such a sophisticated product that it literally had identified JS files, so JavaScript files, JS files that had malicious code in them. And it's really super important that you have tools like this at your disposal, and various layers of protection, so that your computer systems do not get hacked. So I will post a link to that article about the drive-by downloads and JavaScript hacking again, if you're interested in that topic, you can check it out further. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, you can email me your questions and comments.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.